Chapter 12, the last chapter. We're leaving now. Explode gloriously. It was just sunset when Ensign Ed Jacoby trudged ashore after losing the fight against the West Virginia's fires. As he started toward the Ford Island BOQ for a sandwich, a bugle sounded evening colors. He snapped to attention, and the simple ceremony, taking place as always despite the day's disasters, reminded him that the country lived on, that it had survived blows in the past and could do so again. Nurse Valera Vauble stood at attention, too, as the flag was lowered at the Navy hospital. Then she joined some others in a spontaneous cheer. At least this sundown she was still free. But how much longer no one knew. Certainly not Ensign Cleo Dobson, as he sat on the veranda of the old BOQ, talking over the future with some of the other Enterprise pilots. About all they could decide, they were in a real shooting war and right on the front line. Somebody suggested food, and that seemed a good idea, for they had eaten nothing since leaving the Enterprise at 6 a.m. They raided the deserted kitchen and found some steaks in the refrigerator. The salt and utensils had all disappeared, but they cooked the steaks anyhow on the big range and ate them sitting on the veranda. It was dark now, but they could see well enough by the flickering light of the flames on the Arizona. Farther down Battleship Row, acetylene torches flared on the upturned hull of the Oklahoma, but the rest of the harbor was dark. Within the blacked-out ships, men had their first chance to rest and worry. On the Raleigh, everything had happened so fast during the day that Yeoman Charles Knapp didn't have a chance to be scared. But now he was off watch, and as he lay on a desk for a few minutes' rest, his mind flooded with questions. Would he ever see his mother and sister again, or watch a football game, or love a girl, or drink a beer, or drive a car? Certainly the outlook wasn't encouraging. Knapp heard that paratroopers were now dropping on Waikiki, that more landings were in progress on the North Shore. And, as if the Japanese weren't enough, the Germans were flying the planes. There was no doubt about it. One seaman swore that he had seen one of the captured pilots, a big blond-headed Prussian, even heard him talking German. On the gunboat Sacramento, word also spread that one of the pilots was blond, but he was apparently some kind of blond Japanese. Others spoke of huge six-footers, quite different from the Japanese everyone was used to. Even more terrifying were the stories that the pilots were Hawaiian-born or American-educated. Seaman Frank Lewis of the Dobbin heard that the Japanese who crashed on the Curtis were wearing a University of Oregon ring. At the Marine Barracks, Private E.H. Robeson heard that he was a University of Southern California man, class of 37 or 39, people weren't quite sure which. At Fort Shafter, Lieutenant William Keogh heard that the pilots were wearing McKinley High School sweaters. They were all apparently lettermen. The cards seemed stacked against the defenders. The men at Fort Shafter could well believe the story that a Japanese admiral boasted he would dine at the Royal Hawaiian next Sunday. And what was to stop him? Rumors spread that the ships at sea had also suffered. Quartermaster Handler of the helm heard that the whole Enterprise task force was sunk. On the Tangier, Bosun's mate William Land heard that the Lexington was gone too. Not just the Lexington, but the Saratoga as well, according to a story picked up by signalman Walter Grabansky of the California. Nor would there be any help from home, judging from another raft of rumors. The Panama Canal was bombed and blocked, someone told Chief Jack Haley of the Nevada, and this, of course, cut off the Atlantic fleet. But worst of all, California itself was said to be under attack. On the Helena, men heard that San Francisco was bombed. On the Tennessee, that an invasion fleet lay off the city. On the Rigel, that the city had been taken and a beach had established. It might even be a two-prong attack because word reached the Pennsylvania that a Japanese landing force had occupied Long Beach and was working its way toward Los Angeles. True, there were a few encouraging reports. California seamen heard that the Russians had bombed Tokyo, and among the West Virginia men, word spread that the Japanese had so little steel they had filled some of the bombs with oyster shells. Perhaps the best news of all circulated among men from the Oklahoma. Survivors of the attack would get 30 days' leave. Also, the Maryland PA system announced that two Japanese carriers had been sunk, and a more lurid version of this story spread through the Navy hospital. The Pennsylvania had captured two carriers and was towing them back to Pearl. But how could a man believe the good news when even a quick check showed the Pennsylvania still sitting in dry dock? About the best that could be believed was the report, spread on the Nevada, that the Japanese had landed on Oahu. But the army was holding its own. The men on the ship were told to be doubly alert for any movement in the cane that ran down to the shore where the ship lay beached. No one remembered to tell them that the ship's own marine detachment was patrolling the same area. As Private Peyton McDaniel crunched through the cane, a man on the ship shouted he saw something move. A spotlight flicked on, and McDaniel froze, praying it wouldn't find him. Other Marines grasped the situation and passed word to the Nevada gunners to hold their fire. But it was a terrifying moment, for McDaniel knew that this was a night when men were inclined to fire and ask questions later. At the sub-base, one sentry fired so often at his relief that he ended up with the duty all night. In the Navy Yard, a fusillade of shots erased a small spotlight that was snapped on briefly by the men installing the San Francisco's anti-aircraft batteries. Every time such shots were fired, they would set off other guns until the whole harbor echoed with the shots of men who had no idea what they were shooting at. "You want to get in on this?" yelled a Marine sentry as PFC Billy Kerslake dozed off duty in the front seat of a sedan parked near Landing Charlie. Kerslake nodded, reached his arm out of the window, fired five pistol shots into the air, and fell back to sleep. The firing quickly spread to nearby Hickam and added to the misery of the B-17 flight crews. It had been a tough day. First the long 14-hour trip from San Francisco, then getting the planes in shape, bivouacking out in the boondocks, fighting mosquitoes, trying to keep dry in the drizzle that began after dark, and now this. But the firing couldn't be ignored. During one outburst, someone shouted, "The Japs are making a landing." Tired men poured from their cots as the sky blazed with tracers. Sergeant Nick Kalfant added to the din when he jumped out of bed on some thorns. It was an equally sleepless night at Wheeler. Everybody had been evacuated from the barracks area, and no one found a very satisfactory alternative. Private Ray Drenner of the base fire department tossed and turned with 20 other men on the floor of the fire chief's living room. Every time shooting broke out, the men would dash off in their fire truck, dodging the hail of bullets aimed at them by jittery sentries. On the eastern edge of the field, the 98th Coast Artillery let go a covering barrage, kept it up until the 97th at Schofield telephoned to complain that the shrapnel was ripping their tents. Schofield got even when the 27th Infantry took pot shots at the 98th's guard detail. Two other Schofield units engaged in a pitched battle across a gully. It ended when one of the GIs, nicked by a ricochet, exploded into language which the other side knew could come from no Japanese. Down near the pack train corral, a sentry challenged three times, showing remarkable forbearance for this night, got no answer, and shot one of his own mules. The guard at Aliamanu command post bagged a deer, and mess attendant Walter Simmons figured that in the fields around Kaneohe, more mongooses died than on any other night in history. About 1:30 a.m., a small flare burst above Kaneohe. No one yet knows where it came from, and men all over the base began shooting at parachutists. It made no difference that no one could see them or even hear a plane. A more tangible target was millionaire Chris Holmes's island in the middle of the bay. The story spread first that paratroopers had landed there. Later, it was only that the Japanese servants had revolted. In any case, a group of men chugged out in one of the few planes that could still taxi and sprayed the place with machine guns. At Ava, a sentry saw a match flicker and almost shot his base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Larkin, who, against his own orders, was absent-mindedly lighting a cigarette. As the shooting crackled all over Oahu, sooner or later someone was bound to get hurt. An elderly Japanese fisherman, Tsutematsu Kida, and his son Kiichi, and two others, were killed by a patrol plane as their sampan passed Barber's Point, returning with the day's catch. They had gone out before the attack and probably never knew there was a war. In Pearl Harbor itself, a machine gun on the California accidentally cut down two Utah survivors while they stood on the deck of the Argonne during one of the false alarms. Lieutenant J.G. Fritz Hebel sensed this kind of thing might happen as he led six Enterprise fighters toward Ford Island around 7:30 p.m. They had been searching for a Japanese carrier, arrived back over the Enterprise when it was too dark to land, were told to go on to Oahu. Now at last they were coming in. Cautiously, Hebel asked Ford Island for landing instructions. He was told to turn his lights on, come on over the field, and break up for landing. Down in the harbor, Marine Sergeant Joseph Fleck on the New Orleans heard the word pass to hold fire. Friendly planes coming in. Ensign Leon Grabowski was told, too, at his 1.1 gun station on the Maryland. So was radioman Fred Glazer on Ford Island. So, probably, were others. The planes moved in across the South Channel and swung toward the mountains. Somewhere a bar opened up, then two, then just about every ship in Pearl Harbor. Tracers crisscrossed the sky, 30s, 50s, 1.1s, everything that could shoot. On Ford Island, an officer desperately ran up and down the sandbags by Utility Squadron 1's position. Hold your fire, hold your fire. These are our planes. In the air, Lieutenant Hebel yelled over his radio, My God, what's happened? Ensign James Daniels dived for the floodlights at the southwest edge of the field, hoping to blind the gunners. The stunt worked, and he swooped off toward Barber's Point. The others weren't as quick or lucky. Ensign Herb Menges plunged down out of control, crashing into a Pearl City tavern called the Palm Inn. Ensign Eric Allen fell near Pearl City, too. He managed to bail out, but was riddled by gunfire as he floated down. Lieutenant Hebel tried to land his damaged plane at Wheeler, crashed, and was killed. Ensign Gail Herman spun his smashed plane 1,200 feet down onto Ford Island, survived. Ensign D.R. Flynn bailed out over Barber's Point, was picked up alive days later by the Army. Daniels hovered alone over Barber's Point. After about 10 minutes, the firing died down, and he blandly asked the tower for landing instructions. They were different this time. Come in as low and as fast as possible. Show no lights. Since he couldn't come in as a friend, he would have to try it like an enemy. He did, and landed safely. On the destroyer tender Whitney, crewman Waldo Rathman felt a good deal better. They really showed the Japanese this time. The gunnery was excellent, and it was a thrill to see those planes fall in flames. It made the drubbing of the morning seem a thing of the past. Watching from her home near Makalapa, Navy wife Jean Gardner couldn't judge the gunnery, but she prayed the anti-aircraft fire would get the enemy. As Mrs. Mitta Townsend, another Navy wife, looked on from her home on the punch bowl, the moon emerged briefly, bathing Oahu in soft but revealing light. She prayed it would go behind a cloud. Mrs. Joseph Galloway prayed, too, pacing the floor at a friend's house in Honolulu. She had no idea what had happened since her husband left for his ship in the morning. Her portable radio blared occasional alerts about planes, but most of the time it was dead. In the background, a distant station faded on and off with dance music from Salt Lake City.